Morning, everyone. My name is Liz Mattern, and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And welcome, everyone, to the 29th Marietta Spring Roundup of the Sunday Morning Speaker Meeting. I've had the pleasure to host Barbara, my friend Barbara. I keep calling her Barbara. It's Beverly. Anyways, you know, it's been brief, and we haven't even known each other 48 hours, and I'm gonna say three things. Number one, we decided within about 5 minutes we're probably sisters from another mother. Number two, she loves this program as much as I do. And number three, she does this a lot. I mean, many times a year for many, many years. So what I've deduced is she's got a really special message. And so I have been super excited to hear that. So please join me in welcoming Beverly Beebe from Dallas, Texas.
Just said to keep it honest.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Beverly Burnett, and I am a very grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. Oh, I have had the best time. Liz has made it special, but y'all are very friendly, and I just felt very welcomed. I know, first of all, 29 years of having this wonderful conference is just, I mean, it's amazing. You know, I hope it just goes on because there's a lot of love and a lot of energy here. And, I've had a wonderful time, so thank you. I love your title, the slogan for the weekend, Celebrate the Miracle. I want you to know you are looking at a miracle, because without the grace of God and the firm instruction of a family counselor at a treatment center, I would not be here today. I am not a sticker for anything. I start something and never finish it, and I have been graced with this program because I have put one foot in front of the other and kept walking. I came in February 9th of 1981, and today I still go to anywhere from 3 to 5 meetings a week, and you might sit and wonder why I do that. Well, I have Al-Anonism, and I love alcoholics. I just love alcoholics. I can spot them in doorways, in shopping malls, at the airport, and so you group them. You know, so I go to a couple of open AA meetings, so I don't have to look for you anywhere. You're right there where I can see you. So, and we're all miracles. We are really all miracles. If we're here today for the first day or the 42nd year or the 50th year, we are miracles because we have kept it up, kept sharing the message. Karen has been more than patient with me. I think if she hadn't already had a gray hair, she got one now. Because I'm dyslexic, and there must have been a space in between one part of the message and another, and I missed the part where I was speaking at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I booked a 12:30 flight out of Atlanta, and I was like, whoa, what are we going to do? So she tried to accommodate my insanity, and we got it all worked out. And then another space, because I overlooked the spot I was supposed to take an Uber. And I thought, I've never done that before. And so, you know, I called my sponsor and I said, they're not picking Princess Beverly up at the airport. And she says, well, God bless you. Now you get to grow spiritually. And so I downloaded the Uber app, found out that I actually had done Uber before, and then I have a wealth of friends. And they're all about 90 years younger than me, but they think I'm cute. So anyhow, so I texted Rob and I says, I've got to use Uber. Can we spend a minute at the meeting tonight? Will you help me what to do? And he goes, like that. So, you know. So I got that all squared away, and I got to ride from the Atlanta airport to here with a kid named Adam, and I talked his ear off. And I he said, what are you going to be doing when you get there? And I says, I'm going to make a talk. And he says, God put you in exactly the right place. I thoroughly enjoyed the music last night. I stayed for quite a while, and what I thought I really enjoyed was not only the music, but the people who were willing to get up and be vulnerable and fun. What I loved was watching everybody have fun do the music. And then I laid awake for quite a while because the sound of the amplifiers were banging in my head. So, I have been waiting to be here for 3 years. The first year was shut down with COVID, and last year I stepped outside my house onto what I thought was a wet sidewalk and slid about 10 feet before I crashed onto the concrete and I shattered my hip. And, you know, it was an awful experience at the moment. But it turned out to be one of the most divine experiences I've ever had, really. I laid in the ice in a pair of pajamas for a while screaming for help, and everything was iced over, so nobody showed up. And then, you know, it's that 11th step, you know, ask for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And what I'm pretty clear, I think I know God said is, well, sister, you can lay out here and freeze or get yourself in the house. And so I flung the broken leg over the good leg and I crawled on my right arm 45 feet back into the house where I could reach my iPad and called my niece for help. And, you know, the whole thing of all that asking for help, you know, they talked about that a lot this morning in the God meeting. I had to ask for help. And this whole last year, you know, I think my prayer to God is, I don't know what to do. So, you know, that's kind of where I am. I think I'm in a complete surrender because after all these years, what I think I've realized is that of myself, I am nothing. Without the power of God, you know, I make bad decisions. I cause chaos in my life. I make other people unhappy and miserable. And with the grace of God and this program and continuing to go to as many meetings every week as I go to, I'm a kind of a decent human being now. Anyhow, my home group is the Awakening Al-Anon Family Group. We meet on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday at the Treach United Methodist Church. And if you're ever in Flower Mound, Texas, please come and see us. So I will get on with things here. I was raised in Chicago, so I'm not completely a Texan. However, I've been there 46 years, but that does not count when you live in Texas. If you were born and raised there, y'all aren't a Texan. And I even had a pickup truck for 20-some-odd years, and it still doesn't qualify. I had a Cummins diesel 3/4-ton pickup truck, and it still didn't make me a Texan. So, I was born in Chicago into what I absolutely am sure today is an alcoholic family. And my dad, I believe, was the alcoholic. They tell you if he quacks like a duck and he walks like a duck, chances are he's a duck. And my dad did a lot of quacking and squawking, and my mom, you know, raised Cain over all of that. And that's what I remember. There was just a lot of fighting around the drinking. I thought it was fun. I thought my dad was the greatest guy that ever walked planet Earth, but my mother was not amused by him, so apparently. So it was a lot of fighting, you know, a lot of fighting, a lot of shirts with buttons that got ripped off and sleeves and, you know, no speaking and that god-awful silence, which is the sound of alcoholism in a home. It was there. We have a book in Al-Anon called From Survival to Recovery, and the first 12 pages of that book really describe my life. And more than almost, I'm not really good at putting things into words. I know how I feel, but I listen to music because, people who write music put the feelings in my heart into words. And in that first 12 pages of Survival to Recovery, they talk about my life and what you do to survive in when you are raised up in an alcoholic home. And I guess my survival was I'm a high-energy kid. I love the outdoors, still love the outdoors today. I'd rather be outdoors than indoors any old day. And I had a bicycle, and I had roller skates, and I had a couple of friends. And what I didn't know is that, you know, it was my survival out of the disease of alcoholism, which I didn't know was a disease until I was 41 years old. I had no idea that I was living in alcoholism until I was 41 years old. So that is a lot of years that you're in, you know, in this disease. I had no idea how to live a regular life. I had no idea who I was. I didn't know how I felt. Kids are supposed to be seen and not heard. There was plastic on everything in the house. My mom paste waxed the floor, you know, and newspapers and keep your kids out of the house. It was just such a controlled, angry environment. The wonderful blessing about my childhood is that my grandmother was homeless because of alcoholism. My grandfather died at an early age and left her nothing. I have a little tiny, I mean, it's only about that big, a little leather purse with a couple of corroded coins in it, and that was the extent of my, of what my grandfather left my grandmother when he died. So she lived with us for 6 months out of the year, and she lived with my mother's brother 6 months out of the year, and she was my guardian angel. In the disease of alcoholism, the alcoholic takes out whatever it is on the wife. We're not Al-Anons until we work a program. We're just affected by the disease of alcoholism. And so the alcoholic takes his whatever, the rage, the disappointment, the guilt, and takes it out on the wife. The wife doesn't know what to do with it, so she'll turn around and smack one of the kids for absolutely no reason at all. And that kid don't know what happened, so he'll turn around and punch his sister, and the sister don't know what to do, she'll kick the dog. And that basically, that was from Elsa Chamberlain, and it is basically the way that I see alcoholism, is that we don't know what to do with how we feel, and we just keep taking it out on other people. And that's what I did. So I was an only child for 7 years, and then my sister came along, and I just beat the crap out of her. I mean, as soon as I could. I'm sorry, I have a potty mouth.
Oh, well.
Don't we all? Do not judge. Anyhow, and if you, I talked to her yesterday, and she says, please say nice things about me. I says, no, I always do. I says, I'm the one who was mean to you. So, and then 3 years after, well, what happened was she was born. And they put a little bed in the middle of the living room, and people marched in and brought presents and said, oh, what a sweet little girl, and oh my God, such a beautiful little baby. And I got jealous. But I don't know what that is. I have no idea what jealousy is. I have no idea how it manifests itself at all. And so I think I'm not good enough. And she's better than me. And there, all the attention. I mean, obviously that's what I was feeling, because I manifested all of those feelings into anger, which is what we do. And it wasn't until my son, until I was in the treatment center environment because of my son, that they gave me a little piece of paper that I had 101 what we now call emojis, and it identified our feelings. And I saw that one, jealousy, with the goofy little face, and I thought, that's how I felt about my sister. And so anyhow, 3 years later, my brother came along, and I didn't have any issues with that. My the alcoholism progressed. I hid out wherever I wherever I could. And my mom, we had a drunken uncle. We always had a lot of drunken people. I mean, that's all we had at our house, quite frankly, except for my grandmother, who took care of me, and she kept my mother from beating the crap out of me. And I just loved her. She would say, Sylvie, don't hit her again. Don't hit her again. But, you know, when you live like that, you don't know. I'd be listening to Don McNeil in the Breakfast Club, and I might be wearing a bowl of oatmeal, and the next morning I might be kissed goodbye and say, have a nice day. Bottom line is, I'd get to school, and I shook until second period because I was so affected by the disease. So time went on. We had an Uncle Jimmy who was dying in the streets from alcoholism, and they
bring him home, clean him up. I thought he was pretty cool because he brought me potato chips and popcorn in little bags. And, you know, I don't know, it's alcoholism. He had brown fingers. His nails were stained. He wore that old trench coat. That was what I thought an alcoholic was my Uncle Jimmy. I had no idea, you know, that it was everybody. It was doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. It was the butcher. It was the corner baker. It could be anybody with the disease. But I had the vision that my Uncle Jimmy was alcoholism. And after the third time or so that they put him in the VA hospital, what they ended up doing, my mother says, I'm done. I'm done with him. Don't bring him here anymore. You know, I'm not cleaning him up again. They would Clorox him in order to take him to the VA hospital. He'd get a job and it wouldn't be too long until it was back again. And, you know, come get Jimmy, he's dying. And my mom said, don't you dare. And I remember that day as clear as if it happened yesterday. I'm done. And sometimes by the time we have tried so hard to help an alcoholic stay sober and have a life that we finally just throw our hands up in the air and say, you know what, I really don't care what happens to you. And that's kind of what happened with my mom. So we ended up, to get away from alcoholism, we made our first geographic. We moved to the suburbs and we were supposed to live happily ever after. And alcoholism follows you wherever you go. It's packed up in the first box that you put on the moving van, and there it is. And she was quite surprised by that because life went on. While we didn't have Uncle Jimmy, my father joined the BFW and became post commander for two sessions, I guess. And, you know, it was just drinking. It was just drinking all the time. So I had my skateboard, or not my skateboard, I had my roller skates, my ice skates, my bicycle, and a swimming pool down the street, and I knew how to take care of myself. I knew how to stay out of the house. When I was a senior in high school, we moved from Westmont, Illinois to Ogden, Utah. And when you get there, you know what's there is a lot of Mormons, and they didn't look like me. I'm a product of American Bandstand, saddle shoes, poodle skirt, duck tail, you know, the whole thing. And I walk in there, and there they are. They are dressed like Mormons. Everything matched. They had their little shoes, and they didn't care about my name. They would say, what religion are you? And if I said Catholic. And that was the end of it. So I had no friends. And I'm a senior in high school, and the fighting is getting worse. And, you know, I mean, and that alcoholism is progressing. My mother thought that it was going to be, Utah was going to cure alcoholism. I mean, she didn't call it that. She just knew if we got over the Rocky Mountains, it was going to be better in Utah. And so my dad met the train drunk, and it started all over again. And I didn't have any friends, and I didn't have a youth center. And, you know, it was just an unbelievable, horrible time of life. Confusing, mostly, because it was supposed to be better. In this beautiful setting, you know, we were right in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I call it today my soul home. I would go back there in a New York minute. And anyhow, it was just this magnificent place, but we had alcoholism. And I don't have to tell you what that looks like. We've all experienced it in this room one way or the other. So, I got through my senior year somehow, and my dad took me to where he worked. It was a big, defense plant, and I got a job. And I don't know if I was there a week or a month, but this foxy guy walked in. Now I dated a little bit, but not much. I mean, I am still very naive. You can very easily pull the wool over my eyes, but I'll catch you in about 3 or 4 days. but anyhow, there is this, oh my God, he had a crew cut. And he smoked cigarettes. Oh my God, I loved it. I mean, there was something about that. And he could do the smoke rings. And he had this big, huge leather tool bag. And he had on a sport coat and a tie and the crew cut. And he got the cigarette hanging out. Got the picture? And in his pocket, he'd pull out this boar hair brush. And he'd get that hair going. Just straighten it up.
And he walked.
Well, you know how they walk.
They're kind of dancing, you know? I am 18 years old, and this is a man. And I'm like, wow. And I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, that's mine, that's mine. That is definitely mine. Well, he was married. But, you know, that... When you have fortitude and tenacity, it doesn't matter. In my mind, it didn't matter. And so he'd come in and I'd say, he's so handsome. Now, he really wasn't. He was truly a fixer-upper. But I was up to the task. So anyhow, they would tell me stories. He's with his wife. He's sleeping in his office, and they've only been married 6 months. And I thought, oh my God, that's terrible. And so every day I was watching him, and I think, oh God, that is just mine. I mean, I just got so into the whole thing. And so one day he comes into my little area. And he kind of brushed into my hair, and he goes, I am officially separated from my wife. Would you like to go out for a date? And I thought I melted in my chair. All my dreams had come true. Now, here he is. He's, get this, officially separated from his wife. And he wants to ask me out for a date. I mean, that's 13 stepping, right? I mean, sort of. We have traditions against that. Our common welfare should come first. And anyhow, it's like, oh. So I take him home to meet my dad. They get drunk in the kitchen before we even get out into the Oldsmobile convertible. And I am, you know, I'm like, wow, this is so cool. It was purple. And my favorite color. And we go out on this date. He drinks even more. We come home. My whole focus is on if he kisses me goodnight, I mean, that's all that I need. And so, you know, gets up onto the sidewalk by the front door, and, you know, I'm sure it was one of these deals, and he kind of tried to zero in, and I was about ready to get my kiss when he flopped into the doorbell, and she came out. I mean, just, and I should have known right there he was a chicken. He jumped into that Oldsmobile convertible, and all you could see was red lights down the street, but I married him anyhow. We dated for a year and a week. He got unmarried, and there were some other major complications that went on. Of course, he was alcoholic, and during that year, I found his car on a number of occasions, and he would miss dates. Of course he did, and I took it personal. I thought if I wasn't so tall, if I was a little bit thinner, if I had some new pedal pushers, if my hair was blonde, if my hair was red, he would have made it here last night. But then I'd get that phone call that y'all have made. I am so sorry I missed this date. But honey, it'll never happen again. I promise you. He said all I did was go into the keg, which was an army barracks with a sawdust floor. And he said, I just went to the keg, was just going to have one beer, play a little shuffleboard, and the next thing I knew, they were locking it up, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I don't know what happened. It took me years in Al-Anon to know that that man was telling me the truth. He first of all sincerely went into the keg to have one beer, and he sincerely meant to pick me up, and he meant it with every fiber of his being. I don't know what happened. And so 9 months, I don't know what happened because I had birth control pills in my purse, but 9 months and 2 days later, I had a baby. And I didn't know how to take care of that baby. I had no idea how to take care of that baby. And I started to scream at that baby. And I started to be impatient. I was restless. I was irritable. And I was discontent. And my husband went off to work. On this first day that we were married, I made a tuna casserole. And he didn't come home at 5 o'clock. So I called him. And then I called him.
And then I called him again, and then he said to me, don't call me again. I'll be there when I get there. And I can stop right there and tell you that that was the story of my life for the next 21 years. I called, and I begged, and I pleaded, and I kept thinking, there is something I can do better. I'll wash and wax his car, I'll mow the lawn, I'll keep the kids quiet, I'll get him to bed before he gets home. Well, he never came home. I had all these weird misconceptions of what life was like. I mean, he left early in the morning and didn't come home until late at night. He wasn't a bar drinker. He bought liquor and sat in his office. And, you know, and we got promoted. We went from Utah, and then we went to Pennsylvania, and we had a little respite from alcoholism in Pennsylvania because we bought a snowmobile, and that became our higher power. But he came home at night. And because they got, you know, we were living in Mountaintop, Pennsylvania, and it snowed a lot those next 4 years, and we had an Arctic cat, and I had a purple snowmobile suit, and the alcoholism slowed up enough that it was almost normal. And I can remember going, whatever it is, it's okay now. Well, a couple of years, 4 or 5 years go by, and he gets another promotion into New York City, well, actually Northern New Jersey, and he gets a job that takes him into New York City, and there are stories about what happened next in the Big Book, you know, about the guy who goes and has, thinks a little scotch in his milk isn't going to hurt, you know, the guy who doesn't drink for a number of years, and then he lolls in the Florida sun and decides to drink, and he's dead in 6 months. And those stories helped me to understand the evolution and the revolution of alcoholism in my life, because I didn't know what was going on. He goes back to New York City, and he's drinking more than he's ever drank before on an expense account. And I'm left there with the kids trying to, you know, keep everything going. I'm good at it. I mean, I am really good at keeping all the balls in the air. I can do it. I mean, I can bury dogs. I can fix things. There isn't anything that this old girl can't do. And I did it. I did it really well. And so anyhow, we ended up in New Jersey for about 5 years, and the alcoholism was really bad. And then he got this big promotion to Texas. And what I didn't know that I know now is that we brought two alcoholic kids and an alcoholic husband to Texas, and I was absolutely out of my mind crazy. But I'm here to tell you that I thought I was fine. That's the real danger. That is, you know, when I finally got into the program, they said, we were told over and over and over that the Al-Anon comes into the program much sicker than the alcoholic, and I am here to tell you that in my case, that was the absolute truth, because I didn't know any different. I was born into it. I married it. I gave birth to two of them, and it was normal, every day, this is the way it is, kind of a life for me. And so time went on. We get to Texas. My kids are stealing from me. I'm asking stupid questions like, where did it go? And they go, oh, I don't know. And you know, if your kids are saying, I don't know, that is the real answer. Do not expect anything different from them, because that I don't know is what happens. And again, you know, one day they came in and I felt so separated from these boys. They're like, they're 15 and a half and 13 and a half when we moved to Texas, and they are full blown drug addict alcoholics. I had no idea. None. No idea whatsoever. And they come in one day, and I felt separated from the life, and they've got this little baggie. And they said, Mom, we have a science project. Would you help us with this? And I thought, well, of course I can help you. I did store-door delivery for no-nonsense pantyhose, and 1 year they did flower pots that they filled with pantyhose, and nobody bought the damn things. And so we had hundreds of flower pots in the warehouse, and they said, take as many as you want. Well, see, I don't know how to have just one of anything. So what I can tell you today is I am not an alcoholic, but I have alcoholism. And I just loaded my van up full of those flower pots, and I took them home, and we moved them from New Jersey to Texas. And so I had all these flower pots, and they want me to help them with the mystery project. And so I got some of that Miracle-Gro super stuff, you know, like times 10. And I filled all my, I had 10 pots, filled them up with dirt, got my little seeds in there, and I put saran wrap on them. I rolled up the blinds in my bedroom and I put the flower pots on the windowsill, and I had a project going. I'm going to tell you what, I came home at lunch every day and I made sure my little pots were fine, and all of a sudden they sprouted. And I had these beautiful, all 10 pots sprouted, and I just kept watering them and turning them and coming home for lunch, and the little boys are running through the house, and I'm making Kool-Aid and chocolate chip peanut butter cookies, and they're like, Mom, knock it off. You know, go to your room. Well, the project was in my bedroom. And so time went on, and they grew. And they grew, and they grew, and they had big, pointy, dark green leaves. And I was convinced, I had convinced myself, the science teacher is going to be in awe of our project. And I thought, oh my God, it's just magnificent. And you know, time went on, and I come home from work. I worked at a bank on a Friday night, and I look, and the pots and the dirt are there, and the plants are gone. Well, what do you do now? You go to the high school at 10 after 7 on a Friday night, and you try to explain that to the science teacher. And I thought, oh, Beverly, you can't go to, it's there, nobody's going to be there. So I had a moment of clarity. You know, I paused. And so I go to get changed, go to put laundry away, and inside the back wall of my young son's closet was the entire mystery seed project thumbtacked up there. I guess you dry it. That might be what his idea was, but I went stark raving mad, lunatic mad. And I have the kind of anger inside of me that starts in my toes, and it comes up until there's this major explosion, and I have no control over it. I have gone mad. And I have done that throughout the years that I was affected by alcoholism. In those first 41 years, I was explosive over and over and over. However, what I did not do was beat my children. I just thought, when you're in that state, that's where my mother was. And I, somehow or other, intuitively, I knew that. And I thought, if I touch those kids when I'm like this, I'll kill them. I knew it. And I would do anything else until that rage subsided and I could control myself. But that wasn't the damage. I probably would have been better off to beat them up, because what I did was emotional damage. I damaged them emotionally with my tongue, with my words, with my actions, with my attitudes. I killed my children's spirit. And that's where it is, you know. And so time went on, and eventually we went to the treatment center to be evaluated. And, you know, here's where, I mean, God has always been in my life. There's a song by Zach Williams and Dolly Parton that says, "There Was Jesus." And the words to that song fit the whole journey of my life, you know, that God was always there for me, you know, in the darkness and the shadows. When I didn't even know it, you know, there was this God that I didn't even believe in. I walked away from the Catholic Church when I was a kid because they wouldn't let us get married. And so I said, to heck with it all. And I walked away. And so I was 21 years without a God. And so at work, Margaret comes to work, and I says, "Where have you been?" She says, "Well, my son went into treatment for alcoholism. He almost died over the weekend." And I says, "Oh my God, what does that look like?" And she told me about her son, Tim, and boy, I had a vision. It was like for 1 minute, God scraped away the denial, and I was able to hear and see and feel what Margaret was telling me about her son. And I said to her, "I don't know where this came from." I said, "Would you write that phone number down for me?" And I went home that night and I said to my husband, "I think I'd like to take Scott, the youngest one, up to the treatment center for evaluation, because Margaret told me about her son and Scott is just like that." Stephen hit it a lot better. He was better at it. Anyhow, We went out there, and it was the end of January, and they said, we know this family is riddled with alcoholism, but we don't know who to keep. And I had a resentment. I thought, my God, I don't drink. You know, Babs Black, a phenomenal old Al-Anon in Dallas, passed away, but she called herself the keeper of the fly, and she would always make sure that her husband's pants were zipped at the appropriate times. And I always laughed at Babs because I thought, you know, I didn't drink, I became the keeper of the fly. And so so we went there and they sent us home, and I said, I don't drink. But there's that thing about the Al-Anon looking much sicker than the alcoholic. So anyhow, I don't drink. And so they says, well, you guys just go on home. You figure it out. When you decide who the real alcoholic is, bring him or her back. Well, it wasn't too many more days. It was the 9th of February. So this is the end of January, 9th of February, 1981. Scott had been busy in the neighborhood robbing all our neighbors. And, you know, it was a successful, I guess it was successful. I was included in that. He took a ring that I had actually worn on Friday, and it disappeared, and you know, I went to put it back on Monday, and it's gone. And it's one of those times that when they said, Mom, we don't know what, you know, what are you talking about? I says, I know I wore it on Friday, and I want it back. And Scott looked at me, and he said, Mom, there's nothing I can do. He says, I did take your ring, and he said, I sold it for whatever I could get, in order to buy what he needed to have, you know, to enhance his habit. Alcohol for a 15 and a half year old is kind of hard to come by, but they were very capable of finding the drugs. Actually, we became the neighborhood dealers but they were selling it out my front door. And they'd run out there and do a little business, and I'd say, who was that? And they'd go, oh, they just called to see if we wanted to play football. And I am so naive, I thought, okay, well, whatever. I'm glad y'all are making friends better than I did when I moved when I was a senior. So, you know, I was just happy about the whole thing. And so when he did that, I chased him down to the bus, and I said, I don't know what you have to do, but I want my ring back. And he goes, Mom, I can't do that. It's gone. It is gone. So anyhow, I came back in, and I called in sick to work, and I was sick that day. I was really sick that day. And so a few minutes later, he called from school, and he said, Mom, if you come and get me, I'll go to that place. Now, you do not have to have a pure motive to be an Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, because he did not. The reason he called me and says, take me to that place, is because the kid he was robbing houses with in my neighborhood had already been picked up by the Denton County Police, and he was in jail. And Scott knew it was only a matter of minutes, and he saw going to treatment as a way out. And I didn't know any better. I went down to the school. I picked him up. I was not capable emotionally, physically, or spiritually to get behind the wheel of a car that day. And I asked the older kid to drive me, and I didn't know they both needed to be there. But, you know, the other one looked a little saintly to me, so, he drove. He wouldn't come in. I signed on the dotted line, and they said to me, the little family counselor, she said, you're going to have to go to Al-Anon, or you can't come back here to see your son. And I said, I work. And she says, well, so do we. Meetings are at 8 o'clock. Find a home group. And get busy on your, because your son can't come back to an old idea. I had no idea what she was talking about when she said, your son can't come back to an old idea. And I thought, well, I just signed away a lot of money, and you're going to tell me I can't come here unless I go to Al-Anon? I mean, like, do you know who you're talking to? I mean, I don't say any of that because I'm afraid of angry people. And that challenges me to today. I still have a hard time sometimes speaking up for myself because I am afraid of angry people. But back then, it was all in my head. And so anyhow, I thought, okay, I'll go to a meeting. And I did it to Spider. Scott went into treatment. It looked better than going to the Denton County Jail. So neither one of us were there for a pure motive. neither one of us. But I'm here 42 years now, and what I know today is that, you know, if you sit there and say to yourself, why, you know, why didn't she just quit maybe after 20 years or after 10 years? Why? Because what I know today is that I still suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and that else I know is that I have more to lose today. I didn't know what I had to lose in the early days. I didn't know, you know, what gifts, and it was mentioned all weekend, you know, what beautiful gifts we get, and we think we come in here to stop drinking or to, you know, behave better or to help them stop drinking. And all the new people that walk into my home group, you know, that's pretty much, I hear it every week when we get a newcomer, you know, I'm here to find out how to get him to stop drinking. And there's no way that you can even begin to explain to a new member, a hopefully new member, that you are not here to help him get sober. You didn't cause it. You can't control it. You can't cure it. But in Al-Anon, we teach you how not to contribute, how to be a contributor. And I didn't want to, I mean, they told me scary things in the beginning when Scott was new sober, you know, that if you gave him $5, you could, that $5 could be his death sentence. And you'll learn how to detach with love instead of hate. How to detach, you know, without feeling resentful or rebellious or, you know, by God, I'm not going to do that for you. Al-Anon softened my heart is what it has done, and it helped me to see the concepts of what the traditions really are talking about, what the principles are. I was in here for years before I knew what the principles were. I just didn't know. And now I have a list of them, and you know, and I try to practice the principles in all my affairs today. I am really aware of how I treat other people today. And I am so sorry I gave Karen a gray hair, but on the other hand, you know, I think I did what I needed to do in a pretty loving way. Anyhow, time went on. Scott's in treatment. I'm going to Al-Anon. And my thought was, after about five times, I would imagine, I had a feeling inside of me that was so, I can't explain it. But in one of the little daily reminders in the ODAP book, somewhere along the first pages of March, it said, somewhere down deep inside, I knew I was home. And I have known I was home for the last 42 years. You are my people, and I have a place here. You reconnected me with a God that I did not understand. And I mean, there's so many. Anyhow, time went on. On the 23rd day of February, my husband took a desire chip at the treatment center, and it really made me mad. Because, well, he saw himself in the jaywalker. And he got a desire chip, and he comes in the car, and he's like gloating, I got a desire chip, and I'm going to be sober. And I said, well, you fool, do you realize what those people are going to think of me? And he goes, it's not about you, Beverly. And I said, yes, it is. I have a youngest son in treatment, and now you're going to stand up there and tell him you're an alcoholic. So I have a kid and a husband that are drunks. What are they going to think of me? And he goes, Beverly, it's not about you. Well, I screamed at him all the way home because I'm good at that. So then the March 30th comes along. Now, I'm going to anywhere between 8 and 11 meetings a week now for the next 8 years. And I'm going to all these meetings on the 31st or the 30th, the 30th of March. It's a Sunday morning. We're getting ready to go to the Alpha Group to an open AA speaker meeting, which I just loved. And my son came in from a grocery night stocking job, and I saw he was drunk. And I said, oh, my God, oh my God, Stephen, you're drunk. And Scott goes, Mom, he's worse than me. And anyhow, I go to the meeting because you already had implanted in me that you only tell me the truth. You don't say, Beverly, you know what you ought to do. You say, Beverly, this is what I did. Or else you say to me, Beverly, I've never had that experience before. But maybe Liz does. And maybe you should talk to Liz. And I began to trust you. I had that feeling of faith and trust in what you were saying. So I went to Bill and I told him about Stephen. And he said, you only have two choices. And I said, really? What would they be? He said, well, you can either ask him to go to the Monday evening meeting with you and George and Scott, or you can ask him to leave. And I said, ask him to leave? He's 17 and a half years old. And I said, that's your only two choices. You go home and explain that to him and tell him if you decide he's not going to AA, do not give him any wiggle room. Tell him he needs to be out by Tuesday. And it's Sunday morning. And I thought, oh, my God. So he woke up around 4 in the afternoon, and I walked in there full of your faith, your courage, and I said, Steve, I need to talk to you. I said, you can either join us and go to the meeting tomorrow night, or you have to be out of the house by Tuesday because this is a sober house. And I said, we can't have an alcoholic, an active alcoholic in a sober house. I said, Dad's sober. I'm going to Al-Anon. Scott's sober. You can't do this. Well, I mean, he sobered up in a minute. What do you mean? Get out of the house. And I said, well, that's just the way that it is. And anyhow, we get ready to go to the meeting. We get in the car. We had a little Mustang, boys in the back seat, you know, George driving, me in the passenger seat. And George catches a glimpse of Stephen in the room. He agreed to go to a meeting. Motive. It was easier than leaving home and having to figure all that out. So he decides to go to a meeting. And George catches him in the rearview mirror, and George says, I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous with a kid that looks like that. He was wearing a Coors hat, a tequila t-shirt, holy jeans, which are like the thing now, but they weren't back then, and these things called titty shoes. And George says, I'm not going. He jumped out of the car. I jumped out of the car because I thought, my God, you know, I need to keep an eye on him. Scott rolls down the window, and he says, Mom, get in the car and drive. We're going to be late to the meeting. And I'm like, I'm caught between the right thing and the right thing. You know, should I go save my husband or should I drive the car? And I drove the car. We walk in and they drag these kids in with me, and Millie's sitting on the sofa, and she goes, who's that? Now, Millie's 93, and she still is an active member. She goes to a meeting every day. And she comes to Al-Anon, and she says to me that night, scared the daylights out of me, who's that? And I said, that's our oldest son, Stephen. And she said, he's half dead. And I said, oh, my God, you go to Al-Anon. Bobby, come over here. She has a control issue. You come over here. Take care of this kid. So anyhow, Bobby tells her, I'm not messing with kids anymore. He says, I work with them, and then they come and they steal my stuff out of my house. And Millie says, I don't want to hear it. Take him. Anyhow, she says, you go there. Anyhow, so I went in to get some coffee, and as I'm walking into the Al-Anon room, the wall was about this wide, the Al-Anon door, the AA door, and the AA door was cracked open. And I thought, well, I'm just going to stand here for a minute, make sure nobody escapes. And I see the young one nod, when they said, would anybody like one day of sobriety? And I see the young one nudge the older one, and he could get up there. And he said, take your hat off. So anyhow, Stephen says, I'm Stephen, and I'm an alcoholic. And Stephen has 42 years of continuous sobriety on that desire chip today. And I had nothing to do with it. Nothing. I went to Al-Anon. I changed my behavior. I started to learn how to say please and thank you. The young one did not stay sober. He went up to another treatment center in Minneapolis, came home, stayed sober a little while longer, got drunk again, and then, it was grim. I mean, Stephen is on the pink cloud. George and I are going to, you know, all these meetings. We've gotten involved in a family afterward meeting on Saturday night at the Alpha Group, and we started to kind of patch back together our very broken relationship, very, very broken relationship, and we learned how to treat each other with kindness. And there's a page in The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. It's one of our pieces of literature, and I think it's around 37, and it says, and we'll talk about courtesy. And then it goes on to talk about how we are so different. My husband was raised in a very Mormon home where every time the door was open, they were in church and they, you know, they ate ice cream on Sunday and they didn't go to meetings and, you know, they didn't say bad words. And, you know, and then I was raised in this drunk house where, you know, God was used in vain every minute of the day. God was used as a punishment. If I skinned my knee and they'd say, God did that to you because you were a bad girl. And so there was all of this difference in us, you know, in how we were raised. And in The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, it talks about the differences. And I began to see my husband in a different light, you know, how different we were raised and how different our circumstances were. And then in the family afterward meeting and sponsors, they said, do something nice for him. And I was like, you gotta be kidding. Really? Like what? And they said, figure out something. And in The Dilemma, it says, you know, speak about courtesy. I read that and I thought, well, okay, I was drying my hair with his towel. Now, there was my towel and his towel, but, you know, I'll just wrap his towel around my hair, and then I'll dry me and put both towels up, and that man dried himself with a soggy towel every day and never complained. Never complained. And I told my sponsor, I says, I dried my hair with his towel, and then I dry me with my towel, and she said, well, stop that and let him have a dry towel. And that was the beginning of it. And then I had to learn how to compliment him. And oh my God, that was so hard. I did not. I'm belligerent. You know, by God, don't tell me what to do. And so I started to touch him and say, I love you. And he didn't run with you too. And then I would say to him, you look nice in blue. And what it also says in The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage is that the alcoholic spirit is as broken as ours. And that it's not my responsibility to rebuild his broken spirit, but I can contribute to that rehabilitation process. And I started that. And it was humbling. And I learned how when we fought, which, I mean, I really want you to know that we were never Ozzie and Harriet. Ever. And then to complicate that even more, after 33 years in a corporate job, he quit and he started a business, and it turned out that it was B&B, which meant I was included in that, and I didn't know that. And we did that work for 35 years. And it was a fun job, but we had to learn how to communicate and what was my responsibility and what was his responsibility. And so we did that. And I learned a lot with that. And I would complain to my sponsor about, you know, how he doesn't always treat me nice. And she says, Beverly, you have a charmed life. If it wasn't for these kinds of things that pop up in your life on a daily basis, where would you grow spiritually? So I want you to know that I grew spiritually using an Uber. And you know, every time that I have to do something new, I grow spiritually. Because what I have to do is the 11th step, pray for the knowledge of God's will for me. And the power is connected to the knowledge. And once I say to myself, you know what, you can do this. So time goes on. Our youngest son, I ended up putting him out of the house when he was 17. He ended up several years later. Actually, when I put him out of the house, I was really in the fellowship. I loved the pie and coffee and the let's go out afterwards. We went. It was so much fun. But then I put that boy out, and he lived in some really bad, dangerous places. And I look at a 17-and-a-half-year-old today, and I think, how in the world did you do that? And I did it because it was the what I knew is that there was no way that with what he was doing to maintain his drug addiction and his alcoholism that he could live in my house. It wasn't possible. And I put him out there. And that's when I went into really working the program. So I want you to know there's a difference between the fellowship and the program. And I started to work the program, and I started to do the steps, and I wrote inventories. I wrote a lot of inventories over the next 5 or 8 years. I began to write in a journal. That one of the ladies in the treatment center was really avid about. She says, my legacy to the ladies I sponsor, she was an AA, is that I want you all to write in a journal. And anyhow, I was writing in a journal, and I took it to Jean one day, and she says, oh, my God, this is like a kindergartner's diary. She says, you haven't got any feelings on there. And that's when she gave me the pictures of the little emoji faces, and she said, before you write anything on a page in your journal, I want you to know how you feel. And then in 1988, my dad was diagnosed and dying of multiple myeloma. A couple of months later, I got a phone call from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. My granddaughter was 6 months old. My son was dying of AIDS. And he was, in 1988, it was barbaric. The treatment for AIDS in 1988 was barbaric. And in February of 1990, my dad died, left the kids a little money. Scott and his wife and the baby came home. And they had told him he'd live a year, and he actually lived 4.5 years. Sarah was 4.5 years old when Scott passed away. And what happened to me is, you know, another one of our books, How Al-Anon Works, it talks about in there struggling with reality. And the only way that I apparently could overcome losing my child was to go into fantasy, which is where I lived for the first 41 years before I ever walked into Al-Anon, because I don't know how to cope with reality. So I hook up an imaginary Airstream to my imaginary Bubba truck, and I go off somewhere in my mind. I take a vacation, and I am not here. And I did that. I left in my mind for the next 5 years because the pain of losing my son was too great for me to endure on my own. I couldn't. Apparently, I couldn't do it. And then one morning, I've got pictures of my little boys on the wall, and they were toddlers, 15 months maybe. And I looked up at Scott's picture that day, and I said to myself out loud, and he's never coming back. And from that day until this, you know, I am able to... There are so many suicides and so many deaths to children in this program. And what I can do, because I've had the experience, is to give you love and comfort. I will never tell you I know how you feel, because everybody in this program feels differently when they lose someone or something that is so precious. But I am here if you need me. And that's my gift. You know, it says that our dark past becomes our greatest asset. And there's been a lot of things in my life, you know, those cigarettes, you know, came to haunt us later on. And my husband's health began to decline in somewhere around 2000. And he ended up on oxygen at night, and then he ended up in full-time oxygen. And we continued to work, actually. And he was 10 years older than I was. And we continued to work until he just couldn't breathe and work anymore. So we finally retired, but he was 80 and I was 71. You know, we just kept going. I mean, because once you stop doing what you love and you sit and you don't do this anymore, you decline, you know, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And I knew that. And so anyhow, time went on, and on March 27th of 2000, on March 23rd of 2018, we celebrated my husband's 37th sober birthday in the hospital. And on the 24th, the doctors came in and said there was nothing else that they could do for him. And they said he needed to go into hospice and, you know, find a facility. And I said, he is not going into a facility, because when he was a little kid, he got polio and he was in the hospital for 3 months and he hated hospitals. And I knew that about him. And I thought the very gift I can give my husband back is to keep him at the house. And so we did hospice at home. And he was there 2 weeks and he passed away on a Saturday afternoon. And there is a journey that began, because I want you to know that guy died and did not take my character defects with him. Not a one. And so the journey now begins. I've been single for 5 years, and it's a whole new life, because while we learned how to not be codependent, we are interdependent. Anybody who is married, you know, and you have a strong program, you still consider the other person's needs. You consider their schedule. You consider, you know, their, you just consider, you ask, would you like to go out to eat? You know, whatever it is. But I don't worry about, I don't want to hover over you. And so we were no longer codependent, we were interdependent. And so at the end, you know, now I am an individual. And when I do something, I have nobody else to look at and say, well, if you hadn't said that, I might not have acted like that. Or if you hadn't done that, I might not have done that. I am responsible for myself for the first time in 77 years. I became responsible for me entirely. I never went to college, you know. I went from my childhood home into the marriage. I was married almost 58 years to the same guy. And here I am. You know, at this phenomenal age, I am learning how to be a single woman, and it's been pretty amazing. And I get to see myself. When I act badly, I look around and I think, oh my God, kiddo, that was all on you. So this last 2022 was the other thing that I did. That because I watch how you live your life. So there's a couple of things that I did. I did not immediately get involved in a relationship, have had no relationships in 5 years because I don't want to cloud this restoration of Beverly. I want to know who she is and what she's capable of on her own. And it's been an amazing journey. And so I'm solo, single. I did adopt a dog, a 4-month-old puppy, right after my husband died, and for $185, I got the man of my dreams. He does everything I want him to do. But I do want to warn you, unless you are a high-energy person, do not adopt a Catahoula. That boy gave me a run for my money, but he kept me occupied. The other thing that I wanted to do was not go into that fantasy life. And I wanted to grieve my husband's death appropriately, daily, and until it was gone. And we had a lot of things, you know. I mean, when I tell you we were not Ozzie and Harriet, we were not Ozzie and Harriet. But in between us, we took each other and considered each other's needs. And I thought that was a great thing. So anyhow, 2022 roll around, I fall on the ice and break my hip and end up, I gotta quit. I end up 6 weeks non-weight bearing, and my son came from Oregon, the oldest one with sobriety and the only one I have. And I didn't want him there because there were things about our relationship that really had not mended. I don't know what it was. It was kind of like innocuous, but it was there. And I thought, I'm healing from this catastrophic injury, and I just can't have that around me. Well, he came anyhow. And what ended up happening is I got to see my son. He stayed 5.5 weeks, and he took care of me. And he was so gentle and so kind and so loving. And my brain disassociated itself from the hip, from the leg. Apparently, it didn't want to have anything to do with anything that was broken. And every night he would come in and very carefully lift my leg up and get it into bed and get me situated. And it was just, he made me breakfast. He made me tea. We watched British mysteries and went to bed early and got up early, and he took care of my dogs, and they started a meal train for me, and we got that going, and every night somebody came and brought me a meal for almost 3 weeks. And when it was time for him to go home, I said, you know, Steve, maybe I ought to think about moving to Oregon and, you know, being closer to you and Shannon. And he goes, Mom, don't ever leave here. He says, I have never seen anybody as loved as you are. He said, the people in your recovery group really love you and care about you and respect you. And he said, you won't ever find that again. So several months after that, I lost a dog, and then an electric line rotted in the backyard. And on December 23rd, a pipe froze above my bedroom and it wiped out my bedroom, my closet, and my bathroom. And I thought, well, I'll be damned. What else can go wrong? But I live in a really old house. And it's always got something. And so I thought, I'd like a new shower. I'd like some new carpet. And all of a sudden, somewhere in the end of February, I realized God said, Merry Christmas, Beverly. I just made all your dreams come true. And you know what? That's the God that I come to understand today. It's the God that I respect. It's the God that I go to meetings to represent and to be a part of this great, beautiful fellowship, to welcome the newcomers and to keep my own program, you know, going and flourishing, because without you, I am nothing. Thank you.